Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tim, we got some dumb crime, stupid criminals coming up a little later for the premium Stitcher subscribers. And we've got crazy ass stories. Plus, international pop sensation Shakira has been robbed, Tim, and it's going to take the Darkness Nation to help find these perpetrators. So stay tuned for that a little later. Yeah, crazy stuff. And we've got them all, Ben. They came out swinging this week with stupidity for us, so we're lucky. Before we get diving in with our guest, I feel like this is a really good opportunity to tie in a quick little movie review.
Okay.
The brand new Sopranos story, right? The Many Saints of Newark has been released. If you were a Sopranos fan like Tim and I, you've probably seen it. If you have not yet, it's an interesting element to the story. I thought that it was fun. It felt a lot more to me like an episode of The Sopranos than it did the movie I've been waiting to see. That doesn't mean it's bad. It doesn't mean that it didn't drive, but it had a pacing to it that felt more like a backdoor pilot for a TV show than it did for the movie that we've been waiting, a decade to get into. It was fun to watch the characters appear. This movie is definitely more about Dickie Moltisanti than it has anything to do with the Soprano family prime, I should say. They're all in it, and they all make, I don't want to say cameos because their parts are bigger than that, but there's a lot going on with the characters, and there's a lot of great little moments that they allude to throughout the Sopranos TV series as we watch Tony kind of in the background making his way. So I thought it was a fun movie, but honestly, I got to tell you, man, while 1 out of 5 stars, I'm going to only go with 3 stars on this simply for the fact that I just didn't feel that kind of, oh shit, yeah, this was the movie I've been waiting to see. But as a backdoor TV pilot, I'll give it a 5 because that was a great opening and introduction. And I hope that they continue either as a new TV series or continue as a movie series. But I do hope they start to punch it up and give you a little bit more gravitas in the series. What was your takeaway on this one, Tim?
You know, I've seen a multitude of different interviews with David Chase, including one last night, where he said everything from, I just wanted to do a movie that reflected the 1967 riots in New Jersey to, I wanted to do something in a prequel for The Sopranos to, well, the network wanted something. And that was the one that came out last night. The network wanted something regarding a Sopranos prequel, so I put it out. Which is kind of that doesn't seem too inspired to me.
Right.
The network wanted something. And I kind of am along the lines that you're toting that it kind of feels like it had a very strong beginning, and towards the middle and end, it loses its way a little bit. You're right. It does focus a lot around Dickie Moltisanti, and in there, it's kind of like David Chase towards the end finds his way. It starts with it very clearly with what I just said there, kind of gives you a roadmap as to where this movie goes. I wish David Chase would have had some real passion behind where he was going with this project. It really did feel like there were too many masters behind what was wanting to be done here. He even stated that he was not happy with the marketing behind this movie because it really did focus, the marketing focused on a young Tony Soprano. And he said, that isn't what this movie's about. So if you're going into this movie expecting the life and times of young Tony Soprano, you're going to be a little disappointed.
But they do lead you to that point where you realize starting in the next movie, it could definitely take that route.
If there is a next movie now,
right. I do want to know, though, did you think that ending to me had a very corny vibe, but I dug that. I love that little spark at the end.
Yeah. And for all intents and purposes, you do kind of get the feeling like this thing could go on, but For every interview I've seen with David Chase, he doesn't make it seem like he wants to take it any further. So I don't know. I mean, but again, after the series was over, he made it seem like it wasn't going any further. So, with that being said, I think I might maybe go a quarter star more just because I I see some of the same brilliance in the movie that was in the TV series. I actually went and watched it. I watched it three times, believe it or not, because I wanted to kind of dissect different parts of the movie. There are certain characters, when you really get down to the nitty gritty, that were really good, and other characters that were doing a bad impression.
Yeah, I felt that way too.
Yeah.
Some of them embodied the characters from the original series, but like, right. I thought the original series, when they would do the flashbacks to Johnny Boy Soprano and Junior, I thought those actors were much better.
Yes.
In those roles. Yep. Not putting down these guys, but maybe it was just that familiarity. I was like, yeah, why did they? But I'm sure that by this time, the guys that played them now look more like they've right. aged 20 years. So,
right. So
crazy stuff
with that. Three and a quarter out of five. I think it was, well meant and a well spirited tribute to the characters as they appeared in the series. But, you know, could it go as a series? After watching the movie, I don't think it could. I don't think it could hold its water for a few seasons. I just don't think. Yeah,
the whole race riot action of the 60s and the kind of thing that took place, I didn't even feel like they did that any justice. I felt like it was just like a background effect of the story.
Well, in that it was meant to just kind of encapsulate that time and then move forward from there. Yeah. Without giving too much away about the movie, I felt like it kind of unraveled itself nicely. So I don't think they would move on with that if they chose to do.
But I'm meaning it more on the line that Chase said I wanted to do a movie about this. That really wasn't a focus of the movie either. It was just kind of taking place simultaneously. It was interesting. The actors, Leslie Odom Jr. was fantastic in it.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Gandolfini really kind of captured some of the looks and mannerisms of his father, James, mm-hmm. Playing young Tony Soprano. And I thought some of the choices were interesting. When you see Tony at first, he's like a 10-year-old, and he looked like AJ to me from the TV series. I thought that was a great little touch.
Yep.
Although the one thing that really bothered me, although her mannerisms and her voice really knocked Livia out of the park, Vera Farmiga looked much more like she should have been Carmela's mom.
Yes, I completely agree. Yeah.
Than Tony's, but that also tells you, right? Was he attracted to Carmela? Was this weird, familiar deal because she kind of embodied two different worlds? You know, Carmela looks like his mother, and he was drawn to this type of woman because he had a weird, throughout the series, kind of a weird vibe with his mom, even though he knew she was trying to kill him, right?
Right.
So yeah, it's strange, but yeah, check it out for yourself. I'm glad it's on HBO Max because I would not want to waste the money in a movie theater for this at this point.
Right.
But that's normally we don't do many of the movie reviews, but obviously this is a great tie-in. Our guest with us today is Giovanni Rocco. The new book, Giovanni's Ring: My Life Inside the Real Sopranos. It's a story of a former FBI undercover task force officer who spent years penetrating New Jersey's crime family in the criminal organization known to law enforcement as the Real Sopranos. Giovanni, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Dave. How are you, Tim? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. Were you a fan of the Sopranos as well?
I was, yeah. From the very beginning, I watched it. I watched the series, and then having lived that life, I go back now, I think it's a little PTSD, so I haven't not watched a movie yet myself, but I'm looking forward to it when I can muster up the energy to do it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Walk us through this, if you would, Giovanni, your involvement in this as law enforcement. Is this something you know, they come to you and ask you to get involved with this? Is this an active type of case that you want to insert yourself into? How does this all go down behind the scenes?
Behind the scenes is just wherever the cases came in, whatever I can get involved in. Early in my career, it was a lot of narcotics purchases. That's where I started out, to street levels, like basically street corner deals, that kind of stuff. Nothing heavy with the deep cover like the Charlie Horse case was, with the book is focused on. But yeah, you start out small and you work your way in, and then the more you get, it becomes an addiction. The adrenaline is an addiction, and the chase, where the investigations go. You don't kind of steer the investigation, let the investigation bring it to you. And as undercovers, we're just another tool in the government's toolbox. So no matter what agency you're working for, and when they're ready to use you, they'll throw everything else against the wall and try to get the targets locked up via an investigation, surveillance. They might do wiretaps, or they'll put informants in. but they'll wait for another cover before they deploy that, because that's their biggest asset. You don't want to burn an asset like, so, you know, where the cases go, that's where we were sent. And then we go in, we kind of, we'll go in, we'll assess it. We'll do one or two meetings, see if a guy is worth it. And if you're a viable target, then we'll continue on with the investigation. In this case, I was there for bona fides on a narcotics deal one night, and it was a significant amount of narcotics out of Atlantic City. And we had no intent on infiltrating the mafia. It was just a simple narcotics deal. You say a simple narcotics deal. It was a larger federal level narcotics deal. And it just morphed into what became Operation Charlie Horse. And that was almost 3 years of my life.
Wow. Now, when you are starting with this and you're undercover with the police and you're, you know, just starting with these, you know, street corner buys, like you mentioned, I mean, do you have a character that you're trying to portray? Are you using a false name in doing this? And do you live in that vicinity? Are you just part of the culture so people are used to seeing you there? What can you tell us regarding that?
Regarding that, early in my career, this is a long time ago, so it's not done this way anymore. But early on, it was just, I was a street kid. I was a street kid from Bayonne, New Jersey, in Hudson County, right outside of Manhattan. So, you know, it was the persona. Back then, when I became a narcotics detective, I grew my hair out, I grew my beard, I put my earrings in, and I looked like an outlaw biker or a strung out drug addict of sorts. You know, I was really skinny and thin. That's the person I went with. And I was buying narcotics all the time in different areas of Patterson or Jersey City or Newark. And it was simple, you know, gangbangers you were buying from off the corners, which is extremely dangerous. You know, a setting where you're going in to have dinner with a guy is much easier. You're in a public place. Well, when you're doing hand to hands on a corner, sometimes that's the most dangerous place to be. Because if you buy off the wrong drug dealer and you walk away with your dope after you purchase it, the guy across the street who runs the other corner might come around and hit you in the back of the head with a bottle. Back then, it was the Gatorade bottles were made of glass. You might get one of those in the back of the head because you didn't buy off the right guy. So, yeah, it's a dangerous life. I mean, just a simple narcotics deal for those. So, you know, but the deeper cases, and when you get into work in organized crime, then they start vetting you out. You better have a legend and it better work, because if you have holes in your story, the underworld will sniff it out real quick. And if you're looked at as being an informant or a rat, as they call them, your life can end in a New York second. But, you know, undercover cop, they might let you live depending on what kind of criminal organization it is. But most of the time, it can mean death to you. It can be a death sentence. So I started out early on just doing purchases and worked my way in. And then the DEA came knocking, and I worked for them for a while. And I built a reputation, took a break for a little bit because I had a family. I had some kids, and cost me a marriage, as it does a lot of law enforcement guys that do this work. And then later on, the FBI, you know, they gave me an opportunity to go to their school, and I received training, and it was a little more intense, and it just amplified my work. I could do white collar crime, I can do organized crime, I can do Colombians, I can do Mexican cartels. Then I was just working anything that came in.
I give you a lot of credit. And again, thank you for serving and doing what you do, because, you know, it takes a special brand of person to be able to step into doing this. Like you said, this is any and every moment of any and every day could end with the end of your life, right? And what you're doing is just trying to infiltrate slowly and break down and give information and hopefully eventually stop a crime ring that's taking place. But do you, when you're vetted now in this, you're undercover, your name was what, Giovanni Gatto?
It was Giovanni Gatto. Was I had multiple aliases. That was the alias that I embraced during this case. Each case, it depends. I had a folder of identities that I could break out, and you know, they had different legends. Each guy was, they were similar yet slightly different. You know, you can't just create a whole new persona. You got to remember, it's hard enough in living your own true life,
right?
How you're making up. You have different social security numbers, different dates of birth, different credit histories. You got to remember your background. So you have to have all these working parts. So while I did have other identities, Giovanni Gatto was the one that I went to all the time.
When you're doing this, though, are you kind of placed in one general vicinity? So like, are you in this area? You're living, you're breathing, you're moving and working in this area, or are you staying in New York, going to New Jersey, pretending to be kind of a hood rat in that area? How does that part of it work?
No, that part, wherever the cases were, I was fortunate. I built a reputation for myself within the Bureau. And once I was trained by them, I could work an international case. I worked cases within the country. I traveled around the country. If you had a case and you were another undercover and you needed to bring me in for bona fides or vice versa, then we would work off. I worked cases out of California. I worked cases. I did organized crime, La Cosa Nostra out of Italy. Guys came here. We did meetings like that. I did a couple of cases like that. And before this Charlie Horse case, I did some undercover work in the New York area with some guys that were making some tapes against some organized crime guys. And they were made guys in the family that were cooperating witnesses, and they would introduce us. So it depends on wherever the case went, that's where you went. So I was a TFO, but I was treated as an FBI agent. Once you become an FBI, a certified undercover, you're a certified employee of the, you're an FBI employee. So I had the benefits of a city cop, but I have the protection and I had the deputization of a federal agent.
When you are working in this case, are you wired through all of this? Is it only on rare occasion that they'll wire you so that you're, if something goes south and you get a pat down from somebody, you're not always in that predicament where it could blow everything out for you?
Well, without giving up too much trade craft, and I certainly wouldn't want to give up the trade craft of the Bureau because it's so sensitive, but yeah, over the years, I started out wearing the basic wires. If you could think back to when I started in the 90s, early 90s, we still had the old recorders that looked like an old beta tape or a VCR tape, and it had two wires coming out of it. Try shoving that down your pants, Jeez. And if you get patted down, somebody's going to see it in there, or they're going to feel it in there. As technology changes, the job has gotten easier, and you might wear multiple ones as backups because you want to have a good conversation and then you miss it on tape. And then you have to testify in the stand. The ultimate goal is to let these guys sink themselves, which in this case here, they did. A lot of guys didn't go to trial because the amount of tapes we made was just tremendous. And there's nothing, you can't fight your own voice. You can't, that makes the worst witness,
Well, talk us through, who were the real Sopranos?
So the real Sopranos were the DiCapacente family. So it depends on who you ask. I was listening to you guys talk about the Sopranos series and David Chase, and it's not to challenge anything he says. I look at it, my life inside the real Sopranos is my life inside Cosa Nostra, because the Sopranos were just a made-up mafia family. But no matter what family you look at, a lot of it resembles real life and fiction that you watched on TV. They might not be as brutal as the series that you watched on TV every week with guys getting whacked, but maybe somebody doesn't get whacked every month, but that life is, the Sopranos are La Cosa Nostra and the way they live. And it is the La Cosa Nostra life. This thing of ours, they call it. That's what makes it across the board. So the DiCavacantes, they were the longest, or they are the longest standing Italian American organized crime family in the country. They've been here organized 100 years. They were here long before the traditional five families. The other five families they're the bigger family. The Cavalcantes never grew to that size, which is kind of what you see in a Soprano series, right? They're not big of a family, but yet they're connected to the New York faction and the New York family, as you watched in the series. That's who the Cavalcantes were. And that's what was introduced to me. The D. Cavalcantes is my capo, my captain, Charlie Stango, eventually, when I became his associate. That's what he explained to me. The D. Cavalcantes answer to, and ultimately are under the umbrella of the Gambino family, the crime family out of New York City, which is John Gotti's family.
Well, talk to us about the mob and mafia. Most of what we know is from shows like, the Sopranos or Goodfellas, the Godfather. How prevalent are their families? Do they still exist like this, or has the main back of that been broken over time?
I don't think the back has been broken. They might have received some spinal fractures or hairline fractures, but it's not entirely broken. They go underground once in a while and then they regroup and they rebuild. And I think they're at the point now where they're rebuilding. And my personal opinion is you'll see them resurface stronger. And if you look at the news and all the things that they're reporting, the Colombo family has had some, they've been popping up in the news a lot. The Philly crime family, they've been popping up. So they never go away. They might go underground for a little bit, reorganize and come back. The guys that I was dealing with, Mike Capo, my captain, Charlie Stango, he was an old school gangster. He is the definition of Cosa Nostra. He's old school. When I met him, he was, as he referred to, seven dimes and two pennies. He was 72 years old. He was an older guy that did the work. He did the ultimate deeds. The guys I met were capable. And when you refer to a guy as a capable guy, he's willing to commit the ultimate deed of murder. And a lot of guys that I was around, they had no problem doing that. Violence was just another way of, you know, we'll try to work it out. But if not, then, you know, if we have to go that route, we'll go that route. So that attitude hasn't changed. The treachery inside the family and the greed is the same as it's always been. What I saw growing up in Hudson County, New Jersey, is still out here and just as strong and prevalent as ever. So they will steal from their own. But yet when it comes to being a family, and a lot of guys that I met, I have to say, were true family guys. They introduced me as a cousin or, you know, a nephew or family. The minute I was welcomed into the crime family, I was welcomed into their regular families as well, their true family.
Were you surprised by that? Were you surprised? I mean, obviously you had to work your way in and earn and get the trust of these people, but to get into the family, was there a hazing type scenario? Were they asking you to take somebody out to show your allegiance to them so they had something over you? How did that work?
No, in my case, an earner. I was making money in the street, so they're not going to come to me and want me to whack a guy out right away. In my case, that did come later, just because of the way the chips fell and the way I came into this family. There was a divide in the family later in the case, so it caused a little bit of a, I don't want to say it was a war, but it was bubbling to be a war. The boss, the traditional boss, who was John Riggi, who some people say John Riggi was the inspiration for Tony Soprano. He was in his 90s and he was going to pass the torch and step down as the boss of the family. When that happened, there was a little bit of a divide in the family and there were sides chosen. My capo, who was on one side, and then Luigi Eri, who fell on the other side. There was, both wanted me to report to them. So it created a little bit of a rift. And there was a sit down. They went to a meeting and, you know, the administration, who are the bosses, they had a vote and they voted that I was going to fall under Charlie because he was a captain in the family. And that's the way it went. So eventually they wanted me to whack out Louie and they gave me the task. The family was going to do it and they asked me to step up and do it.
What do you do in a situation like that? You're law enforcement. They're asking you to step up and do something to, you know, as you're elevating your role with them, and eventually it comes to murder. Is this something that is then you have to go back and discuss with, you know, the police and the FBI and kind of align a system of what we're going to do in this situation? Or is this like a, in the moment, go get this done?
No, in the moment, at that point in the case, I was probably a couple of years into it, making my way around. And then, so yeah, you report back daily. I had a lot of leeway to go where I wanted to, but I had to report back. I had my backup teams out there with me. I had my supervisors I had to report to every day, and I had my reports to do every day. You know, I had to report back every day on the comings and goings. So it's not like I was just a rogue guy out there living this crazy life. So which made it harder to be an undercover, because here I'm balancing my undercover life with my true life. And that's where my crime family and my true family, my real life, collided. Because now I'm trying to juggle. I have kids. I have a marriage in my true life. And then here I don't have kids. So you got to be real careful. There's a fine line you walk. You know, Giovanni Gatto did not have kids. Giovanni Rocco does. So I can't sit there and think kids are cute. If I'm a street guy and that's what I'm portraying myself to be, maybe I don't like kids. Maybe I never aspire to have kids. So I have to live that life like a guy would, you know. I don't like kids. I don't like being around them. You know, if that was my persona, I have to stick to that, because that's what these guys would see.
As you're working your way through this, Giovanni, is there a level of intoxication in doing this work and working your way up, almost like an achievement level and, you know, in real life of, hey, I went from street dealer to this, to that, to this, and I'm getting more ingratiated. Do you understand in the sense of, is there a, do you understand why people are drawn into this world? Or the more that you look at it, are you more like, I don't understand why this doesn't repel everybody from doing this?
Well, yeah, I look at the guys when I grew up. I saw guys growing up in my neighborhood, and if they aspired to be a legitimate businessman, they were richer than rich. They just had a business brain. I look at Charlie Stengel, my captain. He had a brilliant mind when it came to numbers and business and agreements and everything, contracts and all the legitimate, because we did have legitimate things going on. You know, he had the crime family. It wasn't just crime. He had legitimate businesses. He had, you know, businesses he wanted to open with me, things that we were doing. Through the case, he shared with me that we were going to open up a strip club in Las Vegas, and I was going to be the man of it. He would also be the man. You know, there was all these things in motion that were legitimate. And sometimes you look at these guys, even growing up, why the hell did you pick a life of crime? You could have lived a beautiful, comfortable life if you were just a legitimate businessman. But it's the street. It's the life. It's the life of La Cosa Nostra that draws you in. And you feel this. It's almost like that military or law enforcement mind. They share that, but they're just a crime family. That's the underworld side of it. Guys are just drawn to it. They want to be part of it because they're born into it and they're raised around it, and they just want to be part of it. So that might be.
You talked about the fact that they were a family, but that they also would, you know, flip on each other to move up. That's got to be a strange dynamic, right? To feel like you're part of this bigger moving machine, like this family, and they seem to take it very seriously. But if you got to go, you got to go. If you have something I want, I'm going to take it. I mean, that's got to be a strange dichotomy to be a part of.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely. And the deeper you go in, the more you're exposed to it. Like late in the case, when I had the trusted, I mean, I was trusted like a son. My captain loved me like a son. I trusted him. He trusted me. I always kept him at a distance, but he let me in so far as to one day call me up and says, "Hey, check your emails." And a guy that was reporting to me on a daily basis, he was a very successful businessman and he owned his own companies. He accidentally shared his retirement fund, his monthly bank account. And he accidentally sent it with contracts and whatnot. He accidentally sent it to my captain, and my captain called me and says, "Hey, I just sent you an email. Check your email." What are you talking about? Like, we're sending emails now to each other? Like, we don't send emails. We don't communicate with emails. But at this point in the case, there was such a love for each other. He's like, "No, listen, I sent you an email. Check it." I opened it up. And sure as anything, it was this guy's bank account, his 401k or his, you know, IRA. And it was a tremendous amount of money in there, everything he earned through his whole life. And I called my captain back on a burner phone, and that we can talk dirty on. And he's laughing. He's chuckling. He says, "See what I sent you?" I said, "Yeah." And obviously I knew what it was, but for evidentiary reasons, I said, "Yeah, but I don't understand. What are you sending this to me for?" He goes, "That's what so-and-so has in his bank." I said, "Wow, he did good for himself. Good for him." He's like, "Yeah, you see that money? You see the amount? We're going to take it all." And then, like a dime, he turned on this guy, and then he came up instantly. He came up with a scam, how we were going to draw everything from this guy's account, and he was just going to hand it over to us brilliantly. That's the mind of that criminal mind, that business mind that he had. And he figured out a scam within 3 minutes, how he was going to do it and how I was going to facilitate it. And we would pin this guy into a corner, paint him into a corner where he was financially distraught and had to tap into that account and pay us all that money. I mean, that's how fast it happens, you know. And we were living off this guy. This guy's reporting to me, and he's kicking up. He's kicking up to me. I'm kicking up to the captain, and it's going up the chain to the administration.
So sometimes they'd cut the head off to spite, right? I mean, if this guy's a continual earner for you, and he's kicking up to you, you're kicking up to your captain, but you see this one big score. The one big score, in some sense, is worth more to them than the continual kick up, or do they just feel like, "Hey, we can get, there's a shit ton of earners out there. We can find another earner. Let's grab everything this guy's got and we're done."
Right. And I can't share that. If I want to be the voice of reason, Dave, I can't step up and go, "Hey, you know what? Let's think about this. Like, let's look long term," because now who am I to even have a thought?
Right.
You know? He's already. And if I do that and if I insert my own opinion, or I'm too young to do that, I'm too fresh around these guys, that could get you whacked. That could be like, "Oh, now you think you're smarter than me." You know, I mean, in another case, I was told, why do you even think? I don't pay you for the neck up. I pay you from the neck down. I had a guy once tell me that in an undercover case, because he didn't want to hear what I had to think.
Right.
You know,
you were just the doer.
But
you were the doer, the soldier, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
because I always thought, and again, kind of in the comparison to Sopranos, I always thought it's strange. Here they've got this love for one of this affinity, this family vibe. But I was like, God, there's no way that you'd go to kill your own nephew, or your own mother would kind of tip in and be like, "Eh, if he's got to go, he's got to go." And I always thought that was such a weird, disingenuous feel to how they were portraying the rest of the family. But you're making it sound like, "Oh, no, that's really the way it was." If you know,
is the way. Yeah.
You were an important part of the family unless I needed you gone. Then there was no heart broken at all, huh?
Right. Right. And that was on numerous, for me in this case, there were numerous occasions when that happened. I had, you know, the guy that brought me into the case through a drug deal unknowingly brought me in. And he was the guy that I was running around in the beginning. He owed money to somebody in the family, another captain. And that captain, I was in his house one time and basically said to me, listen, this kid, he owes me money. And if he doesn't pay me, I don't care if he's your captain's nephew. I'm going to take this guy's life. I'm going to just let him know I'm going to do it. You know, and it was a business thing.
Doesn't it? Okay, so but as a business thing, thing though, right? You've got to have a sense of some sense of security, but it sounds like it just is a contentious situation that breeds paranoia amongst everybody.
It is, and that's the underworld. So as an undercover, here you are, you have the security of a good job, I'm law enforcement, I'm raising my family, but yet when I portray this skull of a human being that I'm portraying myself to be, even the kids I dealt with on the street corners, like if these kids and today all this technology, if they're going to have their cable shut off, and it sounds menial, but if they're going to have their cable turned off today because they're 6 months due on monthly payments, even though we're doing good business and I'm a regular customer, I might come in for 10 grand worth of dope. Today's going to be the day they rob me. They're going to come up together because that cable bill or my telephone or I got to pay this bill. There's so much pressure there in the underworld because they're living, they're not even letting paycheck to paycheck. It's scam to scam that they might turn around and, you know, drug dealers could turn around and just say, you know what, today's the day I'm taking Giovanni. This guy's going to show up to a deal today with $10,000. I need that 10 grand. So I'm just going to rob him. And that's it. You have no, you know, that's the danger of working undercover work. You never know what you're walking into.
I had a good childhood friend who was an undercover cop for quite a while. And he said the same thing. He's, you know, he'd make these buys and, he said it was really baffling because this guy that he bought from, he thought there was this kind of understanding. And one day the guy just put the gun in his face in the car and started firing. And they got out of there, luckily, without being wounded. But he goes, you just don't know. He goes, you don't understand how hard that is. That literally you think these people kind of have your back because you're bringing them money or you're earning for them. And it's going through. He goes, they don't care. You're nothing to them if they need something right now. You're just another statistic.
Right. Right. And I was built up. I mean, I built a relationship with my captain. And he basically told me later on in the case when he had that ultimate trust in me, like he loved me and trusted me like a son. He told me, listen, no matter what you do in the street, even though you make a mistake. So he basically said to me, even if I kill somebody by accident and they're connected to us or whoever they are, don't worry about it. Even if you're wrong, Giovanni, I will make you right. So basically, if I was a bad guy and I had that kind of protection, you know, if I was a young criminal in the street and I bought into this Cosa Nostra life, he really would not have my back. He would serve me up in a minute. But that's what they say to you. Even if you're wrong, I'll make you right. Don't worry about it. So these kids go out there like cowboys.
Yeah. You're right. The one thing I'm curious about in this is obviously you as an earner have a certain element. It almost feels like a multi-level marketing scam. You got to get people underneath you working, who's got to have people underneath them working. There's always something, and it's a filter down or trickle down effect. How are you? And if you can't explain it fully, I understand that. But I mean, recruiting and getting people underneath you, are they just placing people underneath you? Or did you have to actively pursue to get earners, you know, burning below you?
So I never came into the case wanting to be a gangster. Every time he wanted to explain the life to me, even though I understood the life, I knew because I worked organized crime from a young age back in the days when they had the wire rooms in New York City and we were hitting local bookies on a Sunday. I knew the life. But when it came to this case, I had to dumb it down. I had to create the persona of what I used to be, that young narcotics cop with long hair and biker. So that's the persona I came in with. Hey, listen, I don't know. I might have Italian heritage in me and blood, but you know what? I never lived this. I don't know how this goes. So you got to explain it to me. So he basically held school for me. Because he saw something in me. And because of the way I moved in the street and I made money in the street in the beginning, it creates a buzz. Because where greed is, they go for the money. So if I'm a kid making money or I'm a guy making money in the street, then they come sniffing around. But what happened was when Charlie got to trust me, he looked at me, he watched me, he asked other families. He would purposely put me into other families and then ask those guys, how did my kid do? How did my kid, how did he move himself? How did he present himself? Was it good? You know, did you like him? He was a likable kid. Yeah, good polished kid. Then I took another step towards the ultimate trust of him letting me in. And it eventually, I didn't ask to run a crew, and I didn't ask anybody to kick off to me. He did that. And it eventually, it was like, look, I'm going to find you an office. Stop running all over the place. You need to be central. Because he knew I was running from New York. I was running to Philly. I was running to AC. He says, look, you need a centralized office. I'm going to put you somewhere. And he did, from Nevada. He looked out for me because he was on parole for murder. And he looked out for me, and he watched, and he put me with the guy. And then he created an office for me. And then he told people to report, this is where you need to go. And then he said, look, this is where you, this is your office. This is where you do your drug deals. This is where you do your crime. This is where you sell your swag. This is where you buy your swag. You know, you have a central place. You need an office. And then it was the legitimate businesses could be run out of there as well. And then eventually when he liked it and he trusted me enough, he called me up one day and said, listen, my son needs a job. So give him a job driving a truck, get him a job. And then that came. And then he saw the relationship I was building with his son. And then eventually he called me up and said, listen, you know, I'm going to put Anthony, his son, I'm going to put Anthony under you. I don't know what you mean by that. What do you mean? You're putting him under me? I'm putting him under you. He's going to report to you every day. And then you're going to report to me. And then he started to build a crew. So I didn't really have to go out. And then before you know it, Anthony, his son, started bringing people to me. And then eventually I let Charlie build his crew building. And these guys would think I was a true wise guy, and they were offering, you know, offering their services to us. And that's how the mob works.
Jesus. And in those instances, though, when he's putting his son underneath you, now do you feel kind of like in this pressure cooker? Like, is this son here to kind of report really back to the dad, keeping an eye on me, looking for any fallibility to my story and who I am and what I represent?
Great point. Great point. A lot of days I did think, why is he doing this? Is he doing this to test me? Or is he doing it because he trusts me more than he trusts his son? Is he doing it because he saw something in me that I'm the guy he always wanted his son to be? These things, every single morning I woke up, Dave, when I started my day and brushed my teeth, these are all things I was thinking. Why is he doing this? Is he doing this to stab me in the back? Is he doing it to vet me out? Is he doing it? Why? Why is he doing it? But it all came out because I guess he aspired for his son to be more like Giovanni Gatto. And Giovanni Gatto was. And it got to the point where now your emotions. I grew up in this kind of lifestyle, this culture, the Italian, the Irish, the German culture. That's the neighborhoods I come from. So a sense of family is everything to me. And now I'm becoming part of their family. It's, you know, right. Merry Christmas, you know, happy Thanksgiving, happy birthdays, this and that. We're celebrating everything. We're celebrating kids' birthdays. I'm asking Charlie to look out for his grandkids and, you know, you want me to do something nice for them. Or, you know, when his son would call me up and he was with his kids, say hello to Uncle G, you know, say hello to Uncle Giovanni. And now, you know, hey, Uncle Giovanni. And then you have this guilt. You go home, you hang up that phone and you have the guilt of, because I identify with that. That's like right. My true family. And it plays all these different emotions, which adds into the emotional trauma that you go through as an undercover. You don't feel it while you're in it. You feel it a tremendous deal of guilt later when the case comes down.
Well, Giovanni, as your superiors in law enforcement are watching you and knowing what you know about this, are they telling you, hey, man, you got to find a way to derail this aspect and focus more on this, or do they literally just have to kind of stand back and watch the collateral damage in order to get the bigger story, to get the bigger elements of what they're trying to break down with this crime family?
I guess it's a little bit of both. Early on in the case, you know, we didn't think it was going to become an organized crime case where we infiltrated the longest standing mafia family in the country. We didn't realize that. Wasn't planned. So when it started to happen, you do as an investigative team, everybody gets excited. You know, your support staff, your analysts, your supervisors, all the way down to the Hoover building, everybody gets excited, you know, because that, and it's the buzz that created, like, oh, we haven't done this in years. We haven't, you know, now we're infiltrating the mafia again. Not since Jack Garcia did it, you know, nothing's been done lately. So here's this big case. And there might've been small cases along the way, but nothing to this extent. And my supervisor and myself, thank God he had a great background from New York. He was an investigator for years in the Bureau and he knew the lifestyle and he understood it. So we were able to navigate it. But you get that excitement, especially when they gave me the order to commit murder. That's the ultimate deed, right?
Right.
And we know what that means. Eventually, when they gave me that, I never thought in a million years I'd be asked to do that. And then you realize, well, now the clock is ticking because as the government, we don't go around killing people, not even for any case. So it's not going to happen. We're going to take this case down. But how do I keep it going now that you gave me the deed and the job to do? How do I keep this case going for evidentiary purposes? And it does. It becomes a sexy little buzz that the Bureau. And then eventually there was a discussion that they would make me. I would be a made member of the family after I did this deed. So, of course, as an undercover, that's the ultimate. That's my Super Bowl ring.
Right.
You know, if I had gotten made in a mob. But again, as an experienced undercover, I have to look and say, if it doesn't happen, you know, as much as I would love to be that guy, well, maybe it's meant to be in 10 more years, or maybe it's not meant for me. You know?
Right.
And that's when I realized what an experienced undercover I was, because I didn't get caught up in the prosecutive end of it. That's a prosecutor's job. That's a lawyer's job.
Right.
My job is just to collect evidence, you know. And that's when I looked back and said, you know, now I'm mature. I'm mature undercover. I'm not just some cowboy out there throwing conversations at the wall to see what sticks. I let these guys bring it to me.
Right.
But again, if I didn't do this fast enough, and it was months after they gave me the deed, if I didn't do it fast enough, there was the fear of they would either take it off the table and not do the hit, and then just clip me because I knew about it. Because again, this family's restructuring. So maybe they don't want anybody else in the family to know there was bad blood at the administrative level.
Right.
So if they got rid of the hit, maybe they got rid of me. You know, and my captain was more than capable. Yeah.
Giovanni's Ring, My Life Inside the Real Sopranos, out and available right now. We do have a link for it on today's program guide. You can also go to darknessradio.com, click on our storefront, and go into our Amazon shop. You'll see our subsections for paranormal and true crime. You can find all the books from the authors that we talked to right here and on our site at darknessradio.com. We'll be back. We've got more to discuss with our guest, Giovanni Rocco, right here on True Crime Tuesday. All right, Giovanni, it's interesting to listen to you tell this story, and my agitation level is up, and nerves and paranoia just seeing this. It's like watching a good, mob drama, knowing that this guy's in the middle of all the shit and how are you going to play this out? How do you not get caught? And you were involved in this for what, a solid 3 years?
Yeah. From start to beginning, just shy of 3 years. And it just, you know, it consumed my life. And ultimately, my family paid the price at the end.
Do you have friction amongst you and the family members? I mean, is there ever natural pour over where you end up fighting with any of these guys? Or obviously, you're not going to combat the uppers, because that'll, you know, lead you dead somewhere. But, you know, with the underlings and your contemporaries, is there aggression and irritation and the concern that maybe one of these guys is trying to make their way up and I'm going to just be another stepping stone on that path for them?
Sure. I mean, that was early on in the case, just the stepping stones that I did from the minute I did a drug deal in Atlantic City and I made my way in through this kid, and he was just a low hanging fruit. He's such a low associate. He was actually Charlie Stengel's nephew, to being introduced to Luigi Oliveri, who was a knockaround guy and always aspired to want to be a big guy, who eventually did. And again, I explain all of this in the book. It's too long to go into. But during the case, I now became Luigi saw himself being a made guy one day and the possibilities of it. A guy like Giovanni Gatto and his crew would be great because he can be a good earner. You know, with me being a good earner, he would just take a piece of who I am. So the government, when they said, okay, get away from Luigi, deal with Jimmy. No, get away from Jimmy, deal with Luigi. All right, now put Luigi and Jimmy both on the back burner and go after this guy, Charlie. You know, that's where things get muddy. Because what you're asking me is all these guys that want to aspire to have me with them so we can make money together. Here comes a captain in the family and just goes, no, you know what? Now he's with me because I'm greedy and I want this guy. So it's like a sand shark going up against a great white shark. And Charlie is the great white. And he just comes in like a bully and takes me over. But that doesn't mean Louis can't, he can still hurt me. I'm not a made guy. So if Louis wanted to lash out at Charlie, and it sounds so complicated, but if Louis wanted to lash out at Charlie and show everybody was, he would have clipped me. He would have came at me, or he would have did something. So there was always that, you know, yeah, they're jealous. You know, I had a conversation with Luigi one day. He says, you know, it was almost jealousy. He goes, you're going to be with Charlie, right? And I said, yeah, I'm going to be with Charlie. He wants me to be with him. That's who I picked. And it was in a meeting, and you could see he got physically agitated. And, you know, he always reached for his pocket. And I knew intelligence. I knew that he always carried a .38 in his pocket. That's what the rumors were in the street, and the government informant told them. And he would reach into his pocket almost like he wanted to shoot me, you know. but he would just reel himself back in and go, okay, you really should be with me. But if that's what you're going to do, let me give you a little heads up here. You know who Charlie is. You know, he's a capable guy. He's a murderer. So do I, but you know, you really thrive with me. And then when you go, nah, I'm good. I'm going to go with him. And now you wonder, how's he going to come at us? And later on, my crew started to step up for me. And my crew wanted to lash out at Luigi's crew. And my guys were almost committing, like, you know, they were creating a war. So I had to be real careful what my guys did. And as street guys, they were like, look, let's just go hit them. Let's go lash out at them. Let's do this. And I used to have to reel them in. No, no, no. It's not a good idea right now. You know, it wouldn't be good for daddy. That's how I referred to Charlie at that point. No, it's not good for daddy. That makes daddy look bad. And he's on parole. We got to do this. We got to do that. That's how deep I was in this thing. So there's that balance, that fine balance of just, you know, all these sociopaths and all these greedy people trying to pick at you. And you have to kind of organize them like a chess game.
On the other side of things, you guys are pushing drugs. You're helping. You're kind of a part of the machine that's, you know, affecting so many people. I know at the beginning of this, you said, you know, you got to kind of step away from even watching the Sopranos movie because of PTSD of the things that you've been involved in. How does one, and not necessarily you, but just how does somebody who's involved in law enforcement, who's there to try to help, how do you rectify that with yourself that you know that you're putting the poison out into the system, that you're a part of that moving machine, even though it's, you know, sometimes the outcome is far more important than the moment, but Is that a strange pull on you as well? Because, I mean, these guys are committing crimes. You're a part of that. You know you're affecting families and individuals and kids on drugs. What is that like for you or for any undercover agent?
Well, the beautiful thing is I can't put the drugs back in the street. So anything that I thwarted so many drug deals. And again, when I was given the power that I was Charlie's extension of power, then I was able to say to guys, no, you're not going to do that. You know, I'll take that stuff. When they say to me, hey, I'm going to move X amount of weight of a product. If they picked the product they were going to put in the street. Well, hold on. How good is it? Is it good quality stuff? Well, yeah, it's great quality stuff. It's the best. It's right out of Mexico, wherever it's from, right? It could be anything. Yes, yeah, like almost 100% pure. Well, hold on. I got a guy for that. And what I would do is I would bring in another undercover or I'd bring in myself and I would middle it. No, 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 no. If it's that good, I'll take it. Because if I, as a government agent, are going to buy that dope, it's never going to go back in the street, right? So right. I am, in a sense, the government saving how many lives? Because if I am buying this pure dope that should not be in the street, we're stopping it. We're actually diverting it and putting it into evidence. So we never put stuff back in the street. So anything that went back out, hijackings and stuff like that, nobody, these guys actually had conversations where my crew would sit down and pitch me a job. I had one time, you know, I made a tape against these guys and they hijacking the truck and pistol whipping the poor security guard. And they mapped it all out and they laid it all out for me in a meeting. Here's what we're going to do. And that was like an episode of Sopranos sitting in the back room and they mapped it all out for me. And I listened to him and go, yeah, we're going to pistol whip the guy. We're going to tape him to the chair. They went so far as to talk about getting us one of the lunchbox, the juicy juice boxes for right. The kids at lunch. And, you know, Jesus. Anthony, Charlie's, he says, yeah, I'm going to get two of them. And what we'll do is duct tape it to the guy. So that if we get caught, God forbid the guy bleeds or hemorrhages and he dies, we can at least use it as a defense. Like that's the conversations I would listen to. And I would let them hash it all out on tape. And then I would go, all right, that sounds really good. You know, so you got it all figured out. Let's play this back. And purposely I would regurgitate everything they said on tape and go, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to hijack a truck. We're going to pistol whip this poor old guy that sits in a booth and we're going to duct tape juice boxes to him as a defense. Right. That's what we're going to do. Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't sound like a good plan. And I would literally go, you guys are morons. You're a bunch of idiots. So you want me to go back to daddy and tell him that we're pistol whipping an old guy with juice box? Are you out of your effing mind? Like, are you crazy? And they, well, we got to, Christmas is right around the corner. We got to make money. I said, this is why me and Charlie are figuring it out. Just sit still. And then I would create another scenario where we just steal a truck or, you know, no victims are involved. You know, without giving up tradecraft, we would just go break into something else that we can control and we'd get a score and everybody be happy because, again, greed is greed, right? The minute I start throwing money at everybody, they're all happy. And then right. I look like a genius, you know?
They don't care where it's coming from, right? Just as long as more money's coming in.
Yeah. But, you know, at a Criminal Mind, I had guys after dinner one night. You know, we were standing there outside, and we were in South Jersey, and it was cold and dark, and we were across the street from an Exxon station. And he watched all the cars go in, and he quickly analyzed and says, you know, how many cars went through this gas station while we were standing? You know, I got two guns and some ski masks in the trunk. We can go hit this guy. Nobody will ever know where it is. Let's go hit it. And if you were a true criminal, you wouldn't care. You know, you just get a quick sum scores like that. What are you going to get? $1,000 off a gas attendant? But again, if they're hurting for money, these are the things you're going to do. And we can never do that. It's undercover. I'm never going to go. I can't commit violence as an undercover. I can't victimize somebody. So it's a very fine line. And I would go home, and sometimes I go back to my undercover house, my apartments or whatever. And other times I haven't seen my true family, my real family in days, and hug my kids and kiss my wife. And I would try to go home, and the lights are out and everybody's asleep. And unfortunately, Jan Duffini had passed away in this case. And as luck would have it, I would try to decompress and sit in my own house, turn the TV on, and here's a tribute to him, and replaying the Sopranos episodes, and I get the most violent episode, you know. And that's what happened actually the day that they went on record with me at the pork store, at the real life pork store. I met the bosses, and they went on record with me, and just as a high level associate, that Charlie wanted to know I was there and I was going to be with him. And that's the night I went home and I watched this Sopranos episode and tribute. And there's no rest for me. It was, you know, nightmares and night terrors and sweats, and then wake up and do it all over again.
Jesus. And was it every day? Was it just trying to get that next high, that next score, that next chunk of change to remain relevant to this group?
Well, at that point, I try to have some distance. But when you're going this deep into a case, sometimes they want to know where you are day to day. A guy like Charlie, he's out in Nevada, and he's overseeing everything I do in the Las Vegas area, the New York area. If I'm in Chicago, whoever he's sending me to do deals, he's watching from a distance. So the minute he wakes up, you know, West Coast time, he's calling me. He's got ideas. He wants updates. He wants this. He wants that. And then if I got guys under me, crew, they want to know what's going on. What's the plan today? What are you doing today? Are we doing lunch? Are we just going to meet? And all of a sudden, if you go off the radar, and again, from an undercover point of view, you have to juggle both of these lives. So I would catch a lot of shit from the law enforcement end of it, because I would say, look, I got to go meet a guy for lunch. Another bowl of macaroni. Do we really have to waste time and hours and all manpower for you to go have a bowl of macaroni? Yeah. You know, oh, okay. So you can go with your friends. No, these people aren't my friends. Let's not get this screwed up here. You know? So sometimes guys would think you're starting to live the life, or they make little, they don't realize the stress that they put on you by, I'm law enforcement. I bleed blue through and through. You know, I'm third generation cop. You know, I'm married to a cop at the time. And, you know, I'm on the good guy side, always have been and always would be. And here you are accusing me of having friends that are gangsters. You know, where are we going wrong here? Because I'm wearing jewelry and dressing nice, and, you know, here I am eating at 5-star restaurants, and maybe because they're sitting outside in the car, or, you know, it creates a little bit of a strife, you know. So this is the life of an undercover. People don't realize, and that's why I wanted to write the book, to understand what it's like to do these cases, not just to say, check out this cool stuff that we did with the mob.
What, you know, as you're doing this, and then you've kind of made your dent in this family and in this story, and then you write a book about it, Giovanni. I mean, how does that work in your real life now? Do you still have, you know, do you have to have eyeballs in the back of your head as you're just living a day-to-day life? Because you infiltrated the mob. You put a hit, I don't mean a whack in somebody, but I mean, you put a dent into what they were doing. Is there any chance that could flash back at you at any point?
Sure. Anything. I mean, you know, as law enforcement in general, if you put a guy away for murder, you know, I've had it happen to me over my, as an investigator, not as an undercover, you know, it can happen to a guy that you put in jail, and here you are walking in the mall with your family. You know, my wife used to work sex crimes, and she put a lot of people in jail, and we always had a plan of action because of that. Yeah. With me, it's the treachery, but ultimately Cosa Nostra guys, they realize, you know, you would hope that they realize, I didn't do this to you. You did this to yourself. You know, you just trusted the wrong guy. You let me in, or, you know, and it's almost like, okay, you won this one. You got away with some. And I think the real polished gangsters look at it, and they would say to you, and I've heard guys say it to me personally, and listen, you won this one. Good on you. You know, We got to be a little more careful who we let in now. You know, it might vet in the future, they might start vetting people out. But yeah, you know, I always have eyes in the back of my head. I always did, even without undercover work, just putting guys away from murder or, right, you know, drug deals. And I put a lot of cartel members away working major, major cases. You know, they don't like when you take their money away. I've seized literally millions and millions of dollars in cash from people, and they don't like it. So it's not just this case. It's a bunch of cases. I still have my head on a swivel, but I'm careful, you know, and I realize now what I put my family through. That was the biggest thing. My wife warned me early on, this is not going to end well for our family. And because of my addiction to the life of undercover and my addiction to the job, it's what I felt I was good at. Some guys are great homicide detectives, or some guys are good drug cops or patrol. You know, I was a good undercover. So that's what I wanted to do. That was with the adrenaline that I chased. And I didn't listen to my wife, and I didn't heed her warning, and she was right in the end. And I do have a lot of guilt because it caused our family to be uprooted and relocated. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, we all paid a price. You know, here I did my job, and now I'm being, not that I'm being punished by the government for it, but I was forced to retire. I was forced to move. I was forced to leave everything behind, you know, in every level of law enforcement I knew, and guys that I, when there were promotions or deaths, like I told you, I'm third generation cop. So, you know, when I had friends of mine or family of mine promoted or retired or passed away, I couldn't go to those events later on, you know. And I couldn't even tell anybody why. I just left. I was gone. One day I was there. Next day I was gone. I had a partner for almost 10 years and early in my career. And I was just gone one day. And everybody was calling in, man, asking where, and his response is, I have no idea where he is. I don't know. He just fell off the earth because he had no idea what I was doing.
Right. How dangerous is that out there when you're in the field that you might run into somebody while you're working and you're with part of your crew that knows you as Paco, not Giovanni Gatti and or Gatto. How do you prepare for something like that?
You can't. You know, you want to be, since I've come out and I've written a book and I do some conferences and I do some trainings for law enforcement and I'm involved in the mental health aspect of trying to help guys and girls, you know, with the mental health of the job. I have been to guys, you know, listen, there's law enforcement guys who are connected to the underworld as well. They might have family, or you got to be careful. And the rumor mill gets out. I bumped into a few guys here and there. I had the unfortunate event of, I write in the book how I was at a soccer game. I was off one weekend and I was not Giovanni Gatto. I was Giovanni Rocco. And I went to my daughter's soccer game, and lo and behold, here comes the Gambino guy who I was doing business with, and his daughter happened to be playing my daughter in, you know, in New Jersey tournament. Jesus. And that was the pucker factor, you know. That was one of many, many times that, you know, many slip ups. Sometimes it'd be a slip up on my part because I let my guard down. Other times it might be my support team or my support staff might have made a mishap or a slip. You know, I had my surveillance team one time, they got followed back to the building after one of my deals with Luigi. Luigi had the balls enough that he said, you know, there's a car, and they had counter surveillance out, and they made the G car. And if they literally followed that person back to the FBI building, and I didn't know about it until later on, he called me out on it, you know? So these little things along the way, or, and you know how it is. You don't see somebody for years. Forget being undercover. There was people I didn't see growing up. Here I'm walking down Main Street in Disney. Oh, look at Dave. Hey Dave, how are you? You know, we went to school together. Oh my God, I haven't seen you in years. There's always that Murphy's Law.
Right.
But you know, I never had that really happen to me, except for a couple little times where the one at the soccer game was a bad one, you know, because I put my family in danger, put my family, you know, they weren't going to hurt my family that day. But, you know, eventually they might look at it and say, well, I'm starting to doubt this. And there was a law enforcement leak on the case, which is also in the book. It's, you know, there was a law enforcement leak. We didn't know whether somebody was leaking information to the mob within law enforcement. We didn't know where it was coming from. And, you know, there was that. And I knew every day going in there was a leak. We knew it. And yet I still stayed in the case because of the work, the mission. We're committed to the mission of putting these bad guys away.
Right.
So, yeah, you make sacrifices. But by the grace of God, I'm still standing with my head attached.
Giovanni's Ring, My Life Inside the Real Sopranos. Giovanni Rocco, our guest and the author of that book, the survivor of this true life tale. And fascinating conversation. An hour flew by in the blink of an eye, folks, and we have yet to have even dug deep in into more of the history and stories. But that's something that I want to leave you, the reader, to experience for yourself. The book is out and available on Kindle and hardcover. We do have a link for the book on today's program guide. You can also find it in the Darkness Radio storefront. Giovanni, thank you so much for doing what you do, man, and committing to that life to try to help change other lives and break the back. I do want to know one thing, though. Knowing what you know and knowing that you can never really kill it. You chop the head off and two more will grow. It just takes a while for them to get back. Is that ever a disheartening part of the job, or do you just look at, well, but in that interim, there are a lot of lives saved, a lot of lives that don't end up in the wrong place because this cancer has been stopped for the time.
It's job security, Dave. That's the way I look at it. It's job security for law enforcement. You can't get disheartened that you're going to chop the head off and put it to bed forever. You're not going to. You're always going to fight the monster, But along the way, you save some victims along the way. And in this case, I look at it, thank God they had tasked me to do this murder, because I don't think Luigi would be here today if they didn't task me. So I look at it as I actually did a good deed and saved Luigi Oliveri's life, because I didn't intend to do that, but it just happened to be that way, And I feel for him, because if it wasn't me they tapped to do this, he'd be gone, And that's the underworld. It'll never be gone. We just have to, that's our mission in law enforcement, just to continue to fight that monster. And like you said, if you cut the head off and another one grows back, you just go to that one.
Once you're pulled out of this situation, Giovanni, how quickly does prosecution begin? How quickly does something turn to start making this into a case that's no longer needing an undercover agent, but now we begin the prosecution aspect?
That's where I got nervous, because the prosecution end of it is all the testimony I got to do on the stand. I got to test that. That could drag out for years. That could go on. And with mob guys, and they hire mob attorneys, they could literally drag it out 5 years with some of these guys going to trial. Mm-hmm. But in my case, I was fortunate enough to make the right tapes. I was fortunate enough that these guys said the right things to me and trusted me to the level they did, because most of them, even at their first appearance, some guys just didn't even fight it. They knew when they knew it was me, that it was the undercover, and they knew that they made these tapes, they knew they were done. So a lot of guys, their first appearance for the judge, they would just ask, one guy actually asked the judge, just put me in the can now. Let me start serving my time. I'll get credit. Just put me in. Because they knew not going, they couldn't go to trial. So in my case, it was good, because I was preparing for a wave of prosecution and trials, but it never happened because they all pled out.
Fantastic. Again, get the book, folks, and make sure that you rate and review the book. That helps the authors so that their books move up in the rankings and get a bigger, wider publicity, I guess you could say, on all of these different selling factions. So thank you, Giovanni. Thank you for coming on today and spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You got it. Stay safe.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
All righty. Fascinating stuff, Tim. Man, that is an unbelievable life. I can't even imagine what it would be like to live that life, to do that and know that you're doing good, but knowing that you can never truly take a breath or relax, because you could bump into somebody at your kid's soccer game. You could bump into somebody in the happiest place on earth, or you could, just piss off and say the wrong thing to the wrong person, and your work in that case is over.
I know you need a lifetime of anxiety meds. That's for sure. I don't think there's enough meds on the planet to keep you calm in that situation. That's for sure.
God, no. Well, for those of you that are listening to us on Stitcher, thank you very much. We hope that you enjoyed today's program. For those of you that are in Stitcher Premium, you're going to get the chance to listen to Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. So fear not, faithful listener. If you want to be able to access the entirety of the show and get the fun elements at the end of this, if you subscribe, Just go to Stitcher Premium and use the code word Darkness Radio. Two separate words. You should get some deep discount rates in order for a 1 year subscription. And getting that, it's going to get you access to every Darkness Radio episode, every True Crime Tuesday episode, commercial free. But it doesn't stop there. You get all of the amazing program under Stitcher Premium. So there's hundreds of thousands of hours of other style of programs. So make sure you subscribe. For $5 a month, you just can't go wrong. For those of you that are not those subscription people, thank you very much for tuning in. We'll be back again with you next week here on True Crime Tuesday.